From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is The Televisionaries. Today we're catching a train between New York and Chicago with Ruby and Billy in Run. We're pulling out our Allen keys to see if you can build a hit television show. We're looking back at local favourite Love My Way, and we play credit where credit is due and check in with what our critics are watching when they're off duty. Here with me today are my fellow outlaws from the Herald and the Age newsrooms, guide and Green Guide columnist and reviewer Debbie Enker, and calling in from our LA studio is our culture editor-at-large Michael Odato. How are you both?
Very good.
Hi, Louise. Oh, gosh, I love the idea of being an outlaw.
I know. Seems so exotic, especially at the moment. Look, this episode, we're kicking off with Run, the new dark comedy from theatre writer and director Vicky Jones that is attracting attention because of its links to reigning TV queen Phoebe Waller-Bridge. It's about a former couple, Billy and Ruby, who drop everything to be together. However, it's not as simple as just running away together, as neither of them are being completely honest about the lives they are leaving behind and what's ahead of them. Starring Domhnall Gleeson, best known as General Hux in the new Star Wars films, and Merritt Wever, who is in Nurse Jackie, it's fast, furious, and makes long-distance train travel in the US look way more appealing than our local equivalent of a cold pie from the dining car and a seat on the XPT. There are 7 episodes, and it's now screening on Foxtel. Before we jump in, let's take a listen to this clip where Ruby and Billy are sussing each other out after they reunite for the first time in 17 years.
Did you break up with somebody?
Nope.
Do you hate your job?
I've got the best job in the world.
Oh, don't be that guy, because it doesn't work with me. And please don't bullshit me that your life is so brilliantly perfect, because if it was, you wouldn't have texted Ron, and you wouldn't be sitting on this train.
You texted Ron back.
Yeah.
That's what set everything off, okay? So you're blaming other people for choices that you've made like you always do. So
like
back
I always
the fuck
do.
Off. Jesus Christ, you didn't have to call.
Maybe that was a mistake.
Debbie, are you running away with Billy and Ruby?
I am completely running away with Billy and Ruby. I think this is an absolutely wonderful premise that these two people who are now in their 30s made a pact when they were in college, and the critical thing is one of them can text run, but the other one has to text run back. And if that happens, they meet at the end of that day at Grand Central Station and they take off on a train journey across America. And I just think that idea of what would allow you to abandon everything in your life and just get on a train and go is a really seductive start. My book group, we all have very different tastes in what we like to read. It is very rare for us to share a book around the whole book group. A few years ago, I read a book called Ladder of Years by Anne Tyler, which is about a woman who goes to the beach with her family, her husband and her kids, and she gets up and goes for a walk on the beach and she just keeps walking. And everybody in the book group wanted to read that book because that idea of just getting up and walking away from your life was something all the women in my book group were interested in. We're all being, many of us, wives and mothers. It's like, what would drive a woman to just get up and walk out of her life was something we're all like, yep, I want to read that. And I think you get all of that from that first shot of Merritt Wever's face when she's sitting in the car park of a shopping centre. You see her face and you think, oh, this poor woman.
Yeah, it's a very simple phone call between her and her husband about if she's going to be home to pick up the speakers. Michael, look, I'm still stewing on Normal People from last week because you thought that was too slow. So now did Run have enough action for you?
It did. Look, it's a very interesting show. My first kind of takeaway is that this is directed by Kate Dennis, who's a co-producer. She's an Australian director. So like the first chunk of these episodes kind of come from her hand. I think she's brilliant. And I think if she didn't convince you with what she did in The Handmaid's Tale, I think this surely is the confirmation of Kate Dennis as one of Australia's properly graced television directors on the world stage. The thing that's striking here is this is very Vicky Jones. And by that, I mean, it's Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but not quite the same thing. So Vicky Jones, basically, her connection essentially to Phoebe is that Vicky directed the stage production of Fleabag, which predates the TV version. From what I can work out, aside from writing an episode of Killing Eve, this really is Vicky Jones's first full-blown TV series. And it's actually fascinating the ways that it sort of does and doesn't kind of click into that Fleabag-y sensibility. I have to say, being set on an Amtrak I did keep getting distracted by a couple of really Amtrak-y things, which actually bugged the bejesus out of me. Like, for example, they kept calling the room they're staying in a roomette, and it's not a roomette. A roomette is half the size of the room they were in. They are actually in what's called an Amtrak bedroom, and I just sat there. And I guess in the end I was like, maybe it just sounded weird to say, come back to my bedroom. The other thing is, no one who's ever been on a top bunk in an Amtrak has ever had sex. There is barely enough for one person up there, let alone two. So I was, when they both got on the top bunk, I'm like, that is not physically possible. And I'll give a shout out to my friend Tom here, who is my frequent Amtrak adventure buddy, who always has the top bunk because he's smaller than me.
When you see films about train travel, it's train travel as you would love it to be. Australian trains, in my experience, do not look like that. But that's actually one of the great things of watching this series. You know, it's got mystery, it's got romance, it's got thriller aspects, it's got lots of surprises, but it's got a lot of interior spaces. And the way that they're shot and lit is superb. Incredible. It looks gorgeous.
Incredible. It kind of landed with me like a bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing. And by that I mean it sort of starts out as some kind of fulfillment of like a romantic college promise. It could be any rom-com you've ever seen. But then suddenly you're watching it going, this is a bit darker and a bit weirder and a bit more compelling. It's interesting to see kind of what Vicky Jones either brought to Fleabag or carries from it into this. But I think she's a great writer of twists, and she's a great writer of kind of sort of warped perception, because I think by the end of episode three, you're in like another show, and then like in episode sort of five, you're kind of scratching your head going, this just can't even be happening. This is like what I'm watching is like an entirely different show again. So that, I mean, I found those bumps really thrilling. I thought this kind of thundered along at a cracking sort of very, very exciting pace.
Yeah, I thought the chemistry was off the charts between Weaver and Gleason. It really reminded me of Alfred Hitchcock's film North by Northwest with Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint, where they're two sort of, you know, they're dueling on the train. The chemistry between them builds and builds on this train ride. And I got that same feeling between Weaver and Gleason. And it was really aided by the soundtrack too, which just really pulsed and built up to a crescendo almost. It was just fantastic.
The chemistry is fantastic. But also it's that thing of that Michael was talking about, the surprises. It keeps shifting with the dialogue and with the action in ways that you can't predict, which is what one of the things I loved about Fleabag, that it was constantly surprising you and in a kind of a, did she just say that? Did that just happen kind of way? And their relationship has got that edginess to it as well, which makes it constantly interesting to watch how it develops.
I think like at first kind of glance, it's meant to be this sort of like quasi love story. The idea that are these kind of two good guys who've just ended up in bad situations that they're running from back towards each other. And I think what started to kind of chip into my brain was maybe you throw away the idea that these are two good guys on the run from bad lives to find each other. And actually maybe there's a pair of assholes who are kind of not the good person in their relationship, that actually they're both quite destructive people, that in fact she's not a victim but is in fact the architect of a lot of her problems, and he you know is the same. And I've not seen it to the end. I've only seen what's aired in the US, so I don't know how that plays out, but my gut instinct here is that that's kind of where it's going. But I did think at one point, I was thinking, is the lesson, what's the point here, what's the message? And I wondered if the message was all that kind of nostalgia and kind of perfection that you assign to that high school romance where you made that promise, the if we're not married by 40, let's get married. Maybe it was just only wonderful in the moment and it looks great in hindsight, but that if you actually chuck everything you have out the window for it and you go running, you just kind of end up in a pile of shit. If it was a 2-hour kind of romantic comedy mystery thriller, it would be like a rollickingly awesome film. It's a great TV series.
Okay, since we're on the topic of great TV shows, is there a step-by-step guide on how to build a good TV show? Run comes with an excellent TV pedigree. It was created by Vicky Jones, who directed the stage version of Fleabag with Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Waller-Bridge is now an executive producer of Run and stars in 3 episodes. But is her stamp enough to guarantee a hit? And is there an easy-to-follow IKEA-style template for building a hit TV series? Michael, if you were to build a hit TV show, where would you start?
I suppose the superficial kind of way into that question is to say, can you build a hit? The practical answer is no, because TV is peppered with failures. That said, I'm going to hop out on a limb here and say you actually can build a hit TV show. It's not as simple as it sounds, but we can approach it with the idea that there are assemblable blocks of an idea that you could put together. So if I said to you, mathematics and television is like wibbly wobbly timey wimey from Doctor Who. Let's take it from that and go, restaurant shows are successful.
Mm.
Hamish Blake is popular. It does not logically follow that a restaurant show hosted by Hamish Blake will be successful and popular. Equally, though, you can argue that I would argue you can still punt on both. And by that I mean a restaurant show with the right host or the right show hosted by Hamish Blake could be hits. That's why, for example, MasterChef works and Lego Masters works. So I think if I kind of come at it from the Lego analogy or mathematically, they're hits, but they're built out of maybe half the blocks of a store-bought Lego toy where you basically didn't follow the assembly instructions. So you have to kind of break it open to make it work. I mean, if I get a bit scientific on you, I could kind of go, what do you take from that? If I say to you, we've got to break the assembly instructions to kind of make the hit, the answer is really you've got to take a risk. So I think that while it looks scary, also bears fruit. You know, number 96 exploded at a time when content was stuffy and tight-laced and it was full of sex and nudity. Then American soap opera was schmaltzy and sweet and along came Dallas and made it nasty and savory. You know, American television was very procedural-based and then along came Desperate Housewives and Lost, which took us back to genre. I mean, I think the idea is that you can have monumental hits by departing from the prevailing thinking that actually if you contradict the market, that's really where the greatest success is almost always found, not doing what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. Do you agree, Debbie?
Kind of yes and no, because I tend to subscribe to the view that was put really succinctly by William Goldman, who was a hugely successful Oscar-winning screenwriter who wrote, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and All the President's Men. And he said, nobody knows anything, when he was talking about the film business. And I think that applies with television as well, that you can have your TV history, your knowledge of what has worked at a particular time, your sense of why that has worked at the particular time. But basically there's conventional wisdom and then a show comes along that completely confounds it, breaks the mold, sets a new pattern and everyone goes, yep, we want one of those now. To me, one of the great examples of it is Mad Men, which is a basic cable channel, a period drama about an advertising agency in New York with no actors that people were very familiar with, you know, no headline star. And suddenly it puts that cable channel on the map and changes the nature of what we expect from television. Downton Abbey comes along at a time when nobody's watching period drama or interested in period drama. And suddenly it's like period drama is hot again. Mm. What it's about is really good writing, a really distinctive and imaginative vision, something that can break the mold, and really good casting. But there's also this indefinable serendipity and good timing and luck. Things that you can't control. And that's kind of the magic of television, I think. If everybody could build a hit, everybody would build a hit.
Timing is everything, and timing is often the thing that is least discussed either in the market generally, in analysis of the TV business, or even indeed in television executive offices itself. The idea that an idea has to be produced at just the right time, or that some shows are a bit early and some shows are a bit late and they succeed or fail because of that. There's a really good musical example, just to randomly grab something, which is that, remember the song Mickey by Tony Basil? Hey, Mickey. Well, the beautiful history of that song is that it was actually released originally with the name Ricky, and it was, hey, Ricky, you're so fine, you blow my mind, hey, Ricky. And it was a monumental failure. And 12 months later, Ricky was changed to Mickey. The song was re-released and it became number one all over the world. It's a great lesson in timing where you just kind of got to, you've got to step into a space in the market, and those, the market is constantly shifting. Those spaces are constantly opening and closing, and it is a, it's a funny little maze.
Yeah, but all those ingredients you're listing are self-explanatory. If there's a formula to create hit TV shows, then why aren't networks doing it?
The enemy of kind of risk is kind of financial, the financial uncertainty that comes with it. And there is a kind of culture in television globally, not just in Australia, where executives are kind of guided by the idea that they kind of want to, they want to pre-birth the hit. They kind of want all of the, they want the data to tell them that it's going to be a hit. They want you to come in and say, well, these shows that are just like this, they all worked in Finland and, you know, wherever, and this can be number one here as well. And in some cases that does work. You do have shows like Big Brother and Survivor and American Idol have emerged because they were number one somewhere and they were replicated. And we do, we're in a global village. We do kind of, we have that copy culture. At the same time, you can only, like, you can only milk a cow so many times before she passes out in the paddock. And, you know, she's just got no more ratings hits to give you. And I think television's really bad at that. Television, you know, no one will outlast their welcome at life's dinner party more than a television channel or a TV show.
Especially in My Kitchen Rules dinner party at the moment.
Incredible, incredible. That's why I think we kind of applaud shows like Seinfeld that kind of have the courage to say, we're done. Thank you. We're not going to hang around till season 14 when you loathe us. We're actually just going to leave at the height of our power and become one of the great masterpieces of all time for that very reason.
Yeah, and I know that our free-to-air channels haven't necessarily distinguished themselves with great risk-taking in recent years, but, I mean, if we just look back over, say, the last few, we talked about MasterChef a few weeks ago. MasterChef was a huge gamble from Channel 10 that's paid off, you know, for more than a decade and really changed the TV landscape in lots of ways by sticking a cooking contest into prime time multiple nights a week. Lego Masters was probably a gamble. I've got to say, until I saw the first episode, I thought, am I interested in watching people building Legos? And my answer to myself was, you know what, I'm not really. But then it was cast so well. Hamish Blake is such a good host. There was such a lovely sense of energy and creativity in that room and colour and the way it was shot. It totally won me. I was really surprised by how engaged I was by it. I think The Masked Singer last year was another one that, honestly, I know they promoted it to death, but I actually did not think that show had a chance in hell of working.
I remember looking at it thinking, how is this even a format? And then when you watch it, you go, oh, it's, you know what, it's just, it's really well put together and it's entertaining.
I think it's a bit about what you were talking about earlier, like with the Dynasty Dallas thing. It changes, fundamentally changes something we're familiar with, gives us a new spin on it, and you think, yeah, that's what's been lacking, that great visual sense. Those costumes were extraordinary, and it was just kind of funny and cute and something families could watch together, and the timing was right.
Speaking of timing, it's time for Game Time. Today we're playing Credit Where Credit's Due, but stick around because we're also looking back at local favourite Love My Way, and we check in with what our critics are watching. If you're enjoying this podcast, make sure to check out another new podcast from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's called Good Weekend Talks, and each week you can listen to a full read-through of its most popular cover stories, from inside Scott Morrison's Pentecostal church to the Spanish flu, were we ready for another pandemic? You can listen to the definitive stories that matter to Australians. So after this episode, go and search Good Weekend Talks. For this week's Game Time, we're going to play Credit Where Credit's Due, where I read out the first few lines of the prologue or theme song, typically from the opening credits of a show, and you have to guess where it's from. So choose your buzzers, Michael.
Buzz.
You can do a buzz, Debbie.
If you're going to be buzz, I'll be beep beep.
Okay.
Oh, I love it. Oh.
So this is an easy one to start the ball rolling. This is a story of two sisters, Jessica Tate and Mary Campbell.
Oh, buzz.
Yes.
These are the Tates and these are the Campbells. That's soap.
It is.
A half-hour sitcom parody of soap opera, yes.
The next song is, okay, oh why, oh why, oh why, won't you sing, bring your hips to me, oh, bring your hips, oh, oh, bring your hips to me, to me.
Beep beep.
Yes.
Offspring.
Yes.
Oh, my God. There you go.
Debbie, bloody impressive, because that was a fairly ordinary reading of a song. So it is from Offspring, which is, of course, the show about the life of 30-something obstetrician Nina Proudman. The song is When We Swam by Tao with a Get Down, Stay Down. Okay, next one. Tell me why I love you like I do. Tell me who can start my heart as much as you. Mm. Tell me all your secrets and I'll tell you most of mine.
Oh, I've got no idea.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Debbie, anything?
Oh. No. I feel like the first phrase, there's a glimmer in that first phrase or something, but I haven't got anything for me.
Okay, you'll kick yourself because this is really easy. Mad About You. Starring Paul Reiser and Helen Hunt.
And their gorgeous dog, Murray.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's leave that there. The scores are 1-1, and we'll return for the final round at the end of the show. But right now, let's dive into the back catalogue. For this episode's back catalogue, we're looking at Love My Way, the award-winning cult show that became the first big pay TV hit in Australia and broke the mould for how shows should be. The dialogue was real, plots meandered, and it went for your heart and gut without being sentimental. Claudia Carvin created the show with John Edwards and starred as Frankie, an aspiring artist and single mum to Lou. The show revolved around her life in Sydney and her extended family. Despite being adored by critics and fans, the show only ran for 3 seasons from 2004 to 2007 and was almost a victim of its own success as Foxtel shunted it around different channels. It became a cult hit on DVD and after disappearing from screens for a few years, you can now watch it on the free-to-air catch-up services 10 Play and 7 Plus. Before we have a chat, let's listen to this clip where we're first introduced to Frankie and her housemate Tom, played by Brendan Cowell.
Aren't you working today?
I dreamt about that chair last night. I was sitting in this room that had no walls and no floor, and there was a roof? No, there was these things falling on me, like leaves falling on top of me, and they were black and wet. And hey, Tom, I'm talking to you and you just walk away from me.
Don't tell me your dreams.
Fucking hell, this is interesting.
No, it's not. I'll see you later.
Okay, all right.
I'm sorry, Frank. It's just that other people's dreams bore the shit out of me.
Debbie, is this one of the best drama series Australia has ever produced?
Yes, I think it is. This wasn't a TV series that was cast the way so many Australian TV series were. We were used to seeing Sigrid Thornton and Lisa McCune and Rebecca Gibney. Suddenly there were a group of actors who were not that familiar to us and who were really cast according to how well they could play this fantastic group of characters. And they bring a real richness and a nuance to it. The writing is just extraordinary in terms of its complexity. The way this group of 30-somethings is depicted is continually surprising and deepening. Everything about it was fresh. It was like this huge banner that said, now that you've got pay TV here, this is what we can do with local drama. We can make stuff that is unlike anything you've seen before. And it really was. And I know it wasn't made that long ago, like the 3 seasons were 2004 to 2007. But I went back when I knew we were going to be talking about it and looked at the pilot again, directed by Jessica Hobbs, who's now gone on to work in, you know, the UK and is directing episodes of The Crown. It is such a beautiful piece of television. It stands up so well. I do think it's one of the great Australian drama series.
Yeah. Michael, what did Love My Way do for the Australian TV industry, do you think?
It fundamentally altered television, and there aren't many shows that come along that do that. And I think prior to Love My Way, Australian drama had been this space where when a network commissioned a one-hour drama, essentially they were commissioning a one-hour show that was shot with the same sort of speed and format as A Neighbours and A Home and Away, with only a little bit more rehearsal time. I mean, there was a sameness across Australian drama. And I think what this did was it created a separation where the one-hour drama for Australian TV suddenly was this elevated creature that was capable of much greater dramatic ambition and I think internationally far more portable into markets that historically we'd never gone, like, you know, kind of the premium channel market. The other thing I think it did really powerfully was it changed the cultural conversation in this country about who actually made TV. And I think all of that credit really lands on the lap of John Edwards, who was sort of the center of this story, not just this show, but The Secret Life of Us, Tangle, a whole bunch of shows. And I think what he did was, particularly for female writing talent, what these shows kind of did was they gave them a platform to make something that I don't think Australian television had made before. And it's not just really it's writers, directors and actors. The Secret Life of Us, actors like Samuel Johnson, Deborah Melman, Joel Edgerton, Michael Dorman, directors like Kate Dennis and Kate Shortland, Tony McNamara wrote for that show. Love My Way, there was Claudia Carvin, Asher Keddy, Brendan Cowell, Dan Wiley. Kate Dennis, again, directed. Emma Freeman directed. You know, Tony McNamara, Sarah Lambert, Brendan Cowell all wrote. Tangle, again, a John Edwards show. You know, actors like, you know, Cat Stewart and Don Haney, directors like Matt Saville and Emma Freeman. To bring all of those people through, that transformed our business. And that's, if you look at the present day, you know, Emma Freeman just did Stateless. Tony McNamara, he's got The Great, which was commissioned by Hulu in the US. Kate Shortland right now is directing in the US Black Widow for Marvel. Kate Dennis, who we discussed earlier in this podcast, is directed The Handmaid's Tale. She's just done Run. John Edwards is an incredibly interesting guy because he sat at the center of this whole thing. And I think Love My Way's legacy and the broader legacy of a lot of what John has done is that all of that talent, those people all came through pivotally Love My Way, Tangle, and before that, The Secret Life of Us. And those shows have a kind of tonal connection. But Love My Way, I think, is the kind of the jewel in the crown. It's just this extraordinary masterpiece that just stunned us with its brilliance and broke us into pieces in a way that a show probably hasn't done since. It's an incredible, incredible piece of television.
Yeah, I mean, the fact too that it was on pay TV and it was quite hard to watch because I was living up on the North Coast, so regional New South Wales, and, you know, not many people there had Foxtel. You actually had to go to the DVD shop and put your name down to get the DVDs. And they were so hard to get because everyone was getting them because I think the word of mouth had travelled to watch them because everyone just wanted to watch the hot new thing.
It is, as you said, available on 10 Play. I watched it on 7 Plus. It wasn't made to be seen with ads in it, but now if you watch them on those streaming services, the scenes are interrupted by ads. It really doesn't lend itself to that. So I ended up hunting out old DVDs to try and watch episodes on DVD so that I could watch it uninterrupted by ads because I found them really disruptive.
Love My Way felt very authentic. There was something very true about it. So I often use it as an example of the first show in Australia I ever remember seeing on television where television dialogue wasn't TV dialogue-y, but was quite naturalistic. It was fresh and it was incredibly authentic. It made it feel real.
Yeah. Okay, let's leave it there. Before we finish game time, let's check in to see what you're both watching for the week. Michael, what's floating your boat? Or should I say, who are you riding the rails with, you know, for Run?
I've got to say the battle with lockdown TV has taken a few funny turns with me. I have kind of oddly struggled to find things to focus on. And in the end, I did something incredibly weird last week. I basically spent $180, it's $280 in Australia, joining a thing called Masterclass. And Masterclass is basically an online kind of course thing where really incredibly talented experts in fields teach courses that are presented as like 10 to 15 minute video episodes. Imagine this is a streaming service, which it is because I watch it on my TV. And essentially I've paid this enormous amount of money. But what I have is this is about 80 courses. Martin Scorsese teaches filmmaking. Annie Leibovitz teaches photography. Carlos Santana teaches the guitar. I've done Anna Wintour's course in creativity and leadership, and I have forewarned my bosses that I'm now going to start wearing a power bob and sunglasses to Zoom meetings, and I'm going to insist that I have an assistant. And look, you know what? For me, I think it was really about doing something sort of useful with my TV viewing. I can sit in front of Netflix like a potato and keep cycling through these shows that I think are kind of interesting at first glance, but ultimately just sort of all start to look like each other. And then I thought, or I can actually just spend the money that I would have otherwise spent on going out and eating incredibly unhealthy food in very lovely restaurants in the time I've been locked down to buy this sort of silly annual fee. And maybe I'll come out of this lockdown having had a whole bunch of really interesting and talented people teach an old dog some new tricks.
I think what Michael's watching sounds extraordinary. I look forward to seeing him with the black bob. And I think Anna Wintour answered our big question from earlier about making a TV hit.
Take a risk, take a risk.
Those are all the elements you need. My viewing is not nearly as exciting, although I have really been enjoying it. I've been watching season 5 of the British Police Procedural Line of Duty. Season 5, I missed when it was on Foxtel. I love this series written by Jed Mercurio, who also wrote Bodyguard. It's about an anti-corruption unit in the English police force, and it is taut and suspenseful and exciting, full of action, and has lots of twists in it that you don't expect. And really, I've followed it for 5 seasons and I'm still hooked, and it looks like on the basis of the end of 5 there could be a 6th, and I'll be there when it turns up. So if you like police procedurals, there are all 5 seasons are now available on Netflix. Highly recommended.
Great. Look, mine's also boring, but look, because I know I've mentioned before that I love watching Seinfeld. So when Jerry Stiller died the other week, I then went into a very good little YouTube hole of watching clips of him playing the gloriously cantankerous Frank Costanza in Seinfeld. So I think it's really the mark of a fantastic supporting actor, which is what Stiller was, who was amazingly only in 26 episodes, which he looms so large over the series, but he was really only in 26 episodes. And he just, every time I think of him, he just makes me laugh. When you think of Festivus, you know, he's referencing the Korean War, the handicapped space, the stop short, just the constant yelling. Like, he was a master of stealing a small role, I think. Anyway, let's get back to game time. Welcome back to the final round of Credit Where Credit's Due, where I read out the lyrics of the opening theme and you have to guess what show it's from. Okay, you ready? Okay, love, exciting and new. Come aboard. Oh, we're expecting you.
Come on. Come on. Oh, no. You know everything I do in television lives in the 80s. That's the Love Boat.
It is. It is the Love Boat. Well, the Pacific Princess, the Love Boat, came to Sydney.
It came to Sydney and they filmed a 2-part episode here, and Delveen Delaney played the replacement cruise director from the Australian office of the cruise line, and she basically came on board and spoke in bizarro, like Cockney rhyming slang, you know, going, oh, where are the tin lids? I'm just off for a, you know, I mean, it was a horror story.
The next incredible one, here we go. California, here we come, right back where we started from. California, California, California. Here we come. That's supposed to go up high, but I'm not going to do it. Oh. Teenagers, think teenagers.
Beep, 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 beep. VOC.
Yes, yes.
Oh.
Thank you for the clue.
The song is California, Here We Come by Phantom Planet. Ooh, it's to all. This one's for the win. Let's go. Can you become a new version of you? New wallpaper, new shoe leather, a new way home, I don't remember.
I've got
no idea.
Okay, yeah. The big hint is the show went downhill after the star cut her hair.
Beep, beep, beep. Felicity?
Oh. Yes.
Oh, wow.
I only got it on the basis of the clue, no memory there of the go. Theme song.
I'm going to say I don't remember the theme. I know, and I love that pilot. It was a really good pilot.
Yeah,
I couldn't hum a bar of the theme song if my life depended on it.
That was a tricky one. Debbie, you won.
I can't believe I've finally beaten Michael at one of the quizzes. Make my day, seriously.
Well, look, well done, everyone. Thankfully, I didn't have to sing any of those. So good memories. Okay, look, guys, thanks so much for this week. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, Louise.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks, Michael.
Bye-bye.
If you like the podcast, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And please rate and review us. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael Odato. And Debbie is at Debbie Enker. And you can find me at Lou_Brug. You can also read stories by Michael, Debbie or myself on the mastheads of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We'll catch up with you next time on The Televisionaries. The Televisionaries is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. It's hosted by myself, Louise Rugenreich. It was created and executively produced by Life Editor Monique Farmer and Culture Editor Matt Burgess. The podcast is produced by LapFan, and our head of audio is Tom McKendrick. The Nine Network is the owner of this podcast and the streaming service Stan.